This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, we should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. I am so excited to have today's guests on. We've got David Williams. He is the VP of Policy at the Business Council of BC. For those that don't know the Business Council of BC, they represent 180 of the province's largest employers. David, of course, not only does he have a PhD in economics related to real estate, but he's been studying the province's economy and finances for over 8 years. And he really knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, this is a recovering housing analyst who's got a lot to say about what we're doing right and especially what we're doing wrong in the province of British Columbia. Fascinating conversation. We're going to have to get him back because we sort of went offline at the end and he started talking about his research in the housing space, and we'll have to have him back. But stay tuned for this. We're talking 5 downgrades to the credit rating in BC, the latest BC budget, where the province is at, newsflash, it's nowhere good, Adam.
Yeah. And actually, coincidentally, David used to work with my wife at the Bank of Canada years back.
Right.
And
we have to disclose that as ethical journalists. Good point.
No, but well, funny enough, I think we wanted to have him on the show about, 8 or 9 years ago, but he actually at that time, I don't think he could come on as, in his capacity at the Bank of Canada. So it's right. It's been a long time waiting for David, but it's worth it, Matt. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But before we get to that, Adam, we have that segment that remains nameless, a quick quiz segment to test your knowledge about what's going on in Vancouver, real estate related or otherwise. Adam, I feel like this week, everybody... I got a massage, and the massage therapist, it's funny, I brought this up on the show last week. The massage therapist said she worked over the long weekend because she was concerned about FIFA destroying a month's worth of business for her, that everybody would be leaving. I think I brought that up. Was it to you about, I wonder what the June numbers are going to look like, but
here's someone who's not concerned about business. They're getting massages, like multiple massages, like one a week. Like it was like the life of Riley. You're like, I'm talking to someone who was feeding me grapes, and they said they're concerned about their future. Anyways,
I'm
carry
never
on.
Never too busy for your referrals, Adam. Yeah, the question this week is around FIFA. So Destination Vancouver just released some numbers about hotel bookings for June, the month that FIFA's in town. This has to do with, the hype, underhype or overhype that FIFA's causing. So it's very simple, Adam. Are hotel bookings for June 20% below last year? Are they even with last year? Or are they pacing at 20% above last year?
Wow.
It's very simple. Very simple. Before we get to that, I want to talk about our newest listing, first showings and open house this Saturday, 2 to 4. This is an exciting one, 4291 Brant Street. This is a little known street in East Vancouver. It's technically in Victoria. It's about a block and a half from the Nanaimo SkyTrain station. Quiet tree-lined street. Get this, Adam. A family house, 5-bedroom, 2-bath, corner lot. The outdoor space, this deck, is so dialed. The same family's lived there for over 20 years. It's just a really well-maintained family house. And here's the best part. It's in the TOA, so the transit-oriented development path, up to 12 stories. Perfect house for investors, but more so, I think, people that like to entertain. People that like to entertain outdoors in mature gardens and families. Great house. offered Adam at the sharp price of $1,449,900. That's $1,449,900. Check it out at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, where you can see all of our featured listings. And while you're there, click sell with us, where you can download the sold plan to get your property ready for market easily with a clear plan. And a clear plan to execute getting the highest price in the shortest amount of time. But Adam, let's go back to our FIFA question here.
Yeah, Matt, I just I want to make one clarification here. You said technically Victoria, and for some people not in the know, Victoria, outside of being a city in its own right, is also a sub-market in Vancouver on the east side. So it's in the Victoria.
I will say, Adam, in the sub area of Victoria, but a stone's throw from the SkyTrain, a stone's throw from Trout Lake and the farmer's market that I might even be at before I go to this open house on Saturday morning, and commercial selling, street and selling commercial your craft, drive.
Selling your craft beer that you make in your bathtub. So here's the thing. I want to just touch on one more thing. If you are in the townhouse market or the half duplex market, you might want to think about this house, because honestly, you with the mortgage helper, you're basically in the same price point, right? Payment.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, you might even be, there's no maintenance fee. And I would say this basement suite can get $2,100, $2,200 all day long, especially near the SkyTrain. So no, this is a house that makes sense for a young family looking to get into the detached market. And it's a corner lot. Adam, you've seen the deck. It's unbelievable. But let's get back to our conversation around FIFA, Adam, the most important conversation we're having today. 20% below, 20% above, or just flat from 2025?
Oh, man, this is a tough one. But I'm going to go middle of the road here. I'm going to say it's the same as last year.
Same as last year, which presumably would be disappointing. Adam, you are not correct. It is 20% slower June 2026 than June 2025. Destination Vancouver is suggesting, I think the pricing has something to do with it. The prices are astronomical. It did say July, August, and September are looking much stronger, but June is strangely the moment where hotel bookings are way off. There might be more to this story, Adam, but it makes me a little nervous for all my plans for June surrounding FIFA, but maybe the crowds will be sparser than you think.
And you thought you were going to get $30,000 a month for your garage, didn't you? Was that you?
That was me. never let an opportunity go to waste.
So yeah, you're putting a mattress on the concrete floor. Hang on. So I'm blanking here. Friend of the show, property manager we had on last year,
Seva Roberts.
Seva Roberts. Thank you. I talked to Seva like 2 weeks ago and just ran into him. He was like, "Don't believe the hype." And I think everybody and their dog basically has been approaching property managers saying like, "Hey, I heard I can get $40,000 for my basement suite or whatever for the month." And I think a lot of people have the same idea. And then I think a lot of people in like Burnaby and Coquitlam have been saying, "Oh, maybe I'll rent it out on..." Anyways, his comment to me was, "Don't believe the hype." So
it's not quite as the prices are not as astronomical as you think.
It's not as lucrative and it's not as easy to rent as you think. And there's a lot of hassle with that. There's a lot of people, like, I was thinking about it because we were thinking, maybe this was about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
What should we do this? And should we maybe go away for a month? And, you know, I think a lot of people have the same idea, but imagine packing up all your valuables and belongings, getting your place ready, especially if you have kids.
I did this before. I did it once. And, it was a one and done operation. I found it
stressful,
deeply unsettling. And after all was said and done, I feel like I walked away going, "I could have just picked up a couple Uber shifts. What am I doing here? This is..."
You mean a couple more Uber shifts. Okay. Matt, let's cut to our conversation. This is an absolute great one.
How well the economy's doing.
Yeah, David Williams, VP of Policy at the Business Council of BC.
Enjoy.
Zentera has done it again. Recently named Multifamily Home Builder of the Year by the Home Builders Association of Vancouver and the Canadian Home Builders Association of BC. Zentera continues to move forward on new projects. And their latest, Butte, a new condo community in West Clayton, is now selling. With construction already underway, buyers can purchase with confidence, knowing that the project is moving forward.
Butte offers 1, 2, and 3-bedroom condos located just 3 blocks to the future SkyTrain Adam. These condos come with tons of inclusions like gas ranges, air conditioning, and designer-selected finishes. Residents will have access to the rooftop patio, fitness center, on-site daycare, co-working space, games room, and tons of outdoor space with 3 playgrounds. Estimated completion is summer 2028.
The best deals are happening now. Visit Zentera's home store in South Surrey to get all the details or check out the floor plans at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakwin Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakwin, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with David Williams. He's the VP of Policy at the Business Council of British Columbia. How you doing, David?
Very well. Thank you. Great to meet you both.
Yeah. Thanks so much for taking the time. David, maybe for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the Business Council?
Yeah. So I'm an economist by training. I've been with the Business Council for about 8 years. My role really spans economic policy, fiscal policy, investment, tax competitiveness, and so forth. The Business Council represents essentially the big end of town, the large employers in the province. We have about 180 members. So most of the large employers would be members there. And so we're very concerned about the broad state of the economy.
That's a good starting point, David, for a softball for you to begin here. How is the BC's economy doing from your perspective?
Well, it's pretty subdued. Over the long run, the economy is typically grown by about 2.5% a year. And the outlook really is to grow by between 1% and 2%. Yeah, our forecast for 2025 is about 1.6. The budget's forecast from the government was about 1.5. We just got some preliminary GDP numbers the other week, suggesting it might be around 2%. But either way, you're still talking about an economy that's running 0.5% to a full percentage point below its historical cruising speed. And yeah, we're in a bit of a funk, essentially. We had 4 mega projects that took place over the decade up until about 2022. And yeah, they really boosted BC's economy. These were huge projects. This was LNG Phase 1, Trans Mountain, Site C, and Coastal GasLink. They were huge, and they lifted the economy up, and they made us look, province, look different to Canada's economy. And Canada's economy has been one of the weakest in the world over the past decade. I've described it as a lost decade. So those mega projects really made BC a bit exceptional because we were getting close to average growth thanks to those big projects. But as they started to wrap up, in 2022, the construction started to tail off, and we did get a bit of a lift from production. And we saw that in 2025 as Site C, you know, began and LNG Canada started and Trans Mountain started shipments. We're starting to see that come through in the production side, but the big lift, the really big lift, comes in the construction, and that wrapped up in 2022. So as a result, there's this kind of lull around BC's economy. There's really nothing to propel it forward. And then if you look a bit more deeply, you know, looking past the mega projects, there's this dichotomy between what's happening in the public sector, which is booming, and what's happening in the private sector, which, aside from the production phase of those four projects, there really isn't much going on at all. The economy is extremely weak right across most parts of the private sector. They're either growing slower than average or some of them are contracting outright. So very, very weak in the private sector. But if you're in the public sector, you're golden. But that's not sustainable because our finances are unraveling at a very fast clip. And, this is all borrowed money. Our credit rating is not doing too well. So that's not really a sustainable model for economic growth going forward. So to summarize, a fairly subdued outlook, not really much going on in the private sector, being propped up by the public sector, but that's not really going to be sustainable for the long term.
So it sounds like it's almost like the tale of two economies here. We've got the public and private. What do you attribute this to? Like what's happening? Why is the public sector so strong and why is the private sector so weak right now?
Well, the public sector is strong because the government has increased its expenses dramatically. Over the last 5 years, since 2021, the government's increased its operating expenses by about 40%, 39%. And revenues have only grown by 18%. So, it doesn't matter if you're running a business, a household, or a lemonade stand, you can't grow your expenses at twice the pace of your revenues and borrow the difference, at least not for very long. Eventually, that model catches up with you. So, we're growing operating expenses at twice the pace of revenues. We've increased our capital expenses we've more than doubled those. We've more than doubled provincial debt, and we've tripled debt servicing costs, the interest burden that taxpayers bear to service the government's debt load. So this is borrowed money. We've seen about 40% growth since 2019 in public sector employment and only about 5% growth in private sector employment. In fact, most parts of the private sector are growing slower than the provincial average, other than public administration, healthcare, education. Those have really been booming. But most parts of the private sector economy, as I say, growing. Their employment growth has been below the provincial average.
Just thinking about the end of these four mega projects, is this kind of a normal kind of moment in like a business cycle? Or is something else going on? Is it just a weird anomalous period in which everything that was kind of driving the growth is kind of tailed off at the same time? Where are we at, I guess? Because it feels to me like, there's not a lot of good news. People are leaving the province. Is this like a normal kind of stage and we should be coming out of this? Or what do you think?
Well, if you zoom out from this, just we have to remember that, BC has actually done a bit better than the rest of Canada until about 2022. We were doing all right, and that was because of those mega projects. But we have to remember that Canada is one of the weakest developed economies in the world. Adjusted for population, the economy essentially hasn't grown over the past 10 years. The economic pie that we all get to share and use to pay our groceries and pay our taxes to fund our public services and so forth, it essentially hasn't grown in a decade for Canada. So it's a very, very weak backdrop. This is not exclusive to BC. But we had those four projects that were really once in a generation projects. LNG Canada was the largest project in Canadian history, and but they've wrapped up now. So we're in this lull until we see some further large projects get going. Now some of the public ones will get going, but we haven't reached final investment decision on for example LNG Phase 2 or Sea Lisims or the Red Chris Mountain mine expansion. And so the provincial government and the federal government are pushing all their chips in on trying to get a few of these projects going, because they can be quite impactful and help us get back to a more average rate of growth. But I think if you look past all of those things, the private sector economy in Canada and in BC across the board is very, very weak. And that's a structural problem. That's not a temporary down cycle. It's been weak for a long time and expected to remain so. You have to remember the OECD has produced some forecasts that I wrote up in 2021 that Canada is expected to have the slowest growing economy of any of the 38 advanced economies in the OECD over the decade to 2030 and the three decades after that. So you're talking about 40 years where Canada is expected to record the slowest growth of any developed economy. And that's mostly because of a lack of productivity growth. So this is a really a structural feature of the Canadian economy, and it's true of BC as well.
So what do you attribute that to? So productivity is kind of a key kind of component here. But I mean, if they're projecting out 30 years that Canada's not keeping pace, presumably we can increase productivity over that time. Why is Canada underperforming or wildly underperforming? I think that's going to be shocking to a lot of people.
Yeah, and it is. And that's why I think people, you know, in their lived experience feel that they're treading water to a large degree. I think that's across the board. I mean, if you look at food bank data since 2019, the number of visits to food banks in Canada has increased by 100%. So, you know, clearly people are not doing very well. And, you know, one third of those food bank visits involve children under the age of 18, who are only 17% of the population. So, you know, you don't need to be an economist to know, feel that the economy's not doing that well. People feel it when they're trying to, as I say, pay their groceries, pay the rent, pay their mortgage, pay their taxes. People feel that they're just kind of going sideways and not really getting ahead. The reason why is, you know, again, you know, prosperity is really driven by what happens in the private sector. And the private sector has been going sideways for quite some time. If you look at, for example, capital investment in Canada, we had the big drop after the oil price crash in 2015 and 16. And then we kind of got accustomed to that. And in fact, you know, the level of capital investment, so this is investment in tools, machinery, buildings, engineering structures, pipelines, all those sorts of tools that make people more productive, you know, over time, that hasn't been, you know, if you adjust for population, businesses are investing about 20% less than they were a decade ago. Now, you're not going to have higher prosperity as a country if businesses are investing less per person than they were 10 years ago. And one of the most remarkable aspects about this is that business investment in Canada has been so low over the past decade that it hasn't even been keeping up with depreciation. So as a result, the capital stock, the total amount of tools, machinery, equipment, buildings, et cetera, that workers get to use has actually been shrinking on a per worker basis. And this is some research from the C.D. Howe Institute. Now, you know, as an economist of 30 years or so, I didn't even know that was possible, because when you look in a textbook, countries over time end up with more capital. People, you know, businesses are investing, you're accumulating more capital equipment that makes you more productive. And this is growing over time, and that's how a country becomes, you know, it enjoys a higher and higher income. But in Canada, that's been going the other direction, which, as I say, I didn't even think was possible for the last 10 years. And we really haven't responded to that. We've sort of become used to, you know, expanding the size of government and borrowing the difference between our operating expenses and our revenues. And that's kind of how we've managed to prop up the economy for a little while. But it's running out of road very quickly, as people can feel.
David, can you talk a little bit about how BC fares against the other provinces? One, when it comes to private industry, but then second, when it comes to the public sector?
Well, as I say, we're pretty weak here, and it's been pretty weak in BC, other than those mega projects, which really differentiated us from that. And we have a bit more real estate related activity than elsewhere. But the key thing about BC's economy is, because we've got the largest and the third largest ports in Canada, in Vancouver and Prince Rupert, it means that our goods can go anywhere. They get on a ship and they can go anywhere in the world. As a result, our economy is quite industrially diversified, and that's a strength. And that means, you know, we're producing in lots of different sectors. And so typically, if one sector's not doing very well, another sector is, and that tends to balance out our economic performance over time. So that's a real strength relative to other provinces. The challenge is, as I mentioned, is that just about all of our sectors, other than the production elements of those mega projects, all parts of the private sector economy have been pretty weak. and expected to remain so. And that's the real challenge in BC. In terms of our finances, BC is quite exceptional. Traditionally, British Columbia has run fairly small-c conservative budgets. We've run budget surpluses or balanced budgets essentially over a very long period of time, and we had very low levels of debt. Up until 2021, we had a AAA credit rating from S&P Global with a stable outlook. And then since 2021, we started increasing our operating expenses at twice the rate of our revenues, doubling our capital spending, and we've more than doubled our debt. I mean, we used to increase provincial debt. We used to double provincial debt over about 12 years in British Columbia. And now we're doing that every 4 years, which is quite remarkable. So we've had a tremendous expansion of public sector employment. We've had a tremendous expansion of public sector spending. We've got a $13.3 billion deficit for this year. That's 2.9%. of GDP, of the economy, that's the largest in Canada. So we are running very exceptional public finances and not in a good way. The speed at which our public finances have unraveled since 2021 has been remarkable.
So David, I'm just thinking here, and I think two of these definitely don't make sense based on that answer. But in my mind, I was thinking, okay, 2021, we're coming out of COVID. I feel like the demographics of BC are skewing a lot older and kind of increasingly so. But the fact that we're so much outside the norm in Canada suggests it's the provincial government. Is that your take on what's going on in terms of this crazy spending we've been undergoing for the last 6-7 years?
Well, yeah, clearly the government's fiscal approach has been, you know, as I say, quite exceptional, very different to the rest of Canada. You know, that's what's really attracted the attention of ratings agencies. You know, if you go back to 2021, as I say, we had a AAA credit rating with a stable outlook. We've had 5 consecutive downgrades over the past 5 years. Last year, for example, S&P Global described the province as being at a turning point with respect to the management of its finances. They described BC's budgetary performance as the weakest of its peers. Now, they weren't alone because Moody's also downgraded us last year and also described the province as being very weak. They said that the decline in provincial finances is really due to provincial policy choices. They didn't really buy it's Donald Trump's fault. So, you know, we have taken a view in BC to really open the taps in terms of the spending. And as I say, that model of growing your spending at twice the pace of your incomes or your revenues and borrowing the difference, that only works for so long. So back in 2021, BC had AAA credit rating the same as Zurich or Western Australia or Basel. And over the past 5 years, we've gone from the fiscal strength of Zurich to the fiscal strength of Prince Edward Island, because we are now at the very bottom of the peer rankings for subnational debt. There's only a few jurisdictions in the world that can borrow like we can. We're a subnational jurisdiction, and we can run operating deficits in our budget and borrow for that. The Australian states can do that. The Swiss cantons can do that. There's some Belgian regions that can do that. But there's not many. Mostly you have to be a sovereign. You have to be a nation to borrow. To run operating deficits. Like the US states can't do that. They can borrow for capital, but they can't borrow for operating. Municipalities, same sort of story. So it's a bit unusual to be a province or a state, Australian state, and to be able to borrow like this. But among our peers, we've gone from top tier, same as Zurich, to bottom tier, the same as Prince Edward Island and Newfoundland and Labrador in the space of 5 years. And the outlook, the credit rating outlook is still negative. Normally you get a downgrade and then the outlook kind of stabilizes as you're the new normal. But our outlook is still negative, which means what the credit rating agencies are saying, and they've been saying this for several years, but pretty stern press releases, is that if you remain on this track, we will downgrade you again because we don't think your finances are on a sustainable trajectory.
What needs to change in your mind to stop these downgrades?
Well, There's what I think should happen, but then there's what can happen. And I think at this point, you know, the government is in a very, very deep fiscal hole that's been digging themselves into it, or digging taxpayers into it for the past 5 years. It's very deep at this point. And the government has also just signed on to some very generous collective bargaining agreements with public sector unions for the next 4 years, at 3% a year for 4 years. So that's 1% above the rate of inflation. The Bank of Canada's target for inflation is 2%. So that's 1% better than inflation for the next 4 years. Now, labor costs are about 60% of your budget. So you're kind of locked in on your operating expenses from that. And the other big item is the debt servicing. Now, because debt has expanded so quickly, you've got this enormous loan book that the provinces, you know, has issued. And, you know, debt servicing costs are the fastest rising line item in the budget. In fact, if they were a ministry, they'd be the third largest ministry among all the ministries. We spend more on debt servicing than we do on the, social welfare. It's a very big item, and it's rising very, very quickly. It'll be about 8 or 9 cents out of every dollar of revenue absorbed by the end of the forecast horizon. You know, just on a per capita basis, British Columbians are used to spending about $500 per head of population per year to service interest on provincial debt. In the latest forecast that we have, that number will reach $1,500 by the end of the forecast horizon. So debt servicing costs just triple. So these are really exceptional things that happen. And with the debt servicing costs rising so quickly, and then the government having committed itself to these very generous collective bargain agreements with the public sector workers, that's really removing a lot of flexibility that the government has going forward. And don't forget, you've got a 40% increase in the number of public sector workers since 2019. So you've got a larger workforce, and you're going to pay them above the rate of inflation. And then your debt servicing costs, that's why the government doesn't have a lot of room to maneuver now from that. So my view about this is that what we're going to see is it's almost inevitable in my view at this point that we will see some very significant tax increases or layoffs in the public sector or spending cuts or asset sales, privatizations, because either by this government or an incoming government, because at this point, you know, the government's really run out of room to maneuver. The fiscal trajectory is unsustainable. They tried to stabilize the fiscal track in this budget with $5 billion of increases over 3 years of extra taxes on households and businesses, and some modest efficiencies with some allowing some retirements and attrition in the size of the public sector workforce. But it didn't move the dial at all. We still ended up with a deficit of 2.9% of GDP, you know, a record $13.3 billion. It wasn't anywhere near enough, and it was a $5 billion increase in taxes. So the government's in a really difficult predicament, and any government that is either returned or is a new government, I think, is going to be facing, I think it's almost inevitable now at this point that we need to brace ourselves for either significant tax increases, significant public sector layoffs, or spending cuts or privatizations or asset sales. I think all of those things now, there really isn't much room to maneuver to avoid that.
So pain is coming, David. Necessary pain, it sounds like.
And we got a taste of that in this budget. I mean, $5 billion of tax increases on households and businesses. We had a federal cut with the Carney government. We had a cut to the lowest personal income tax rate. And that's been clawed back by an increase in the provincial personal income tax lowest rate. So we got a freezing of indexation of personal income tax brackets for 3 years. Now it's the third largest item of the tax increases, but because inflation moves people up very quickly, it ends up becoming sort of closer to $1.5 billion of extra taxes by 2030. You don't really see that in the budget because it only goes out for 3 years. But by the fourth year, you're looking at sort of, you know, getting up towards $1.5 billion. So people have got a taster of what's coming in this budget.
You see, like, sounds to me like you're describing kind of a spiral here that is going to be really hard to pull out of. We've painted ourselves into this corner. We have the lowest amount of investment we've had in
decades by the sounds of things in British Columbia, and yet we're raising taxes, which is presumably not a smart thing to do if you're trying to incentivize investment in the province. Do we need a new provincial government at this point? Is that the only way out?
Well, I don't know what will happen politically. I mean, we saw, you know, the economy wasn't doing well for a decade in Canada, and we saw a change of prime minister, and Canadians elected an economist as their prime minister, I guess, because they were concerned about the economy. So I don't know whether it'll be a change in government or a change in party, but the track we're on isn't sustainable. And that's why I think that change is inevitable and probably sooner rather than later.
David, you mentioned that the Business Council represents some of the largest employers in British Columbia. I don't know if you're talking to those folks on a regular basis, but what's the membership's take? If, and obviously there's probably a diverse range, or maybe not, but do you have kind of a sense of what the largest employers in British Columbia think of what's going on right now?
I think there's a great concern across the business community about the state of, you know, private sector economic activity. I think that's a pretty broad-based concern. And there's concern about the conditions for investment in the province going forward. You know, we saw in this budget the expansion of the provincial sales tax, which is it's a terrible tax. It's an absolutely terrible tax. I mean, normally having a broad base for a tax is a good thing, but the provincial sales tax, it just costs a lot of economic activity to raise the revenue, and the province expanded the PST into accounting services and engineering services and security services, some other professional services in this budget, you know, which is just going to be embedded into the costs of doing business in the province. You know, we have this very negative signal coming from the budget about the taxes are going to have to be significantly higher in the future. And that really makes a business think twice about whether they're going to base and build their operations in BC. It makes a young worker, think about whether they're going to build their life in British Columbia, or they're going to move to Alberta or to another country where wages are higher and taxes are lower and there's more economic opportunities. I think that is the broad concern, that what are we going to do to get the economy going again? And that's where we need to be looking at some, you know, a better approach. We're sort of heading headlong in the wrong direction. We need to be making our tax system more competitive, not less competitive.
How hard is it to get the credit ratings to bump those scores up? And maybe as a secondary question, can you talk about who's looking at those credit ratings and what is the impact, like in very easy terms for people to understand, for regular everyday people in British Columbia?
Well, as I say, it took us 5 years to dig ourselves into this hole. First thing we need to do is stop digging and stop making it any deeper. That's the first thing. But it's probably going to take 5 to 10 years to dig out of this. It's a very, very deep problem. So we can't look for quick fixes on this. The government's really got to get a handle on its operating spending and its capital spending and start paring some of that back and looking for a bit more value for money and a bit more outcome focused from the government. What does this mean for people? Well, again, we used to spend per head of population about $500 a year per person across the province to pay interest on provincial debt. Now we're going to be paying $1,500. So it's a tripling. And then having a credit rating makes that even.
And sorry, just to be clear, is that because the debt becomes more expensive because we're deemed to be a riskier bet? Is that the logic there?
That's right. We're deemed a less creditworthy province. So when we go to market to sell our bonds, we need to sell our bonds so we can raise the money to cover our deficit. We have to pay more for it. And we used to borrow at a discount to Ontario, for example. We used to get better prices, if you like, lower interest rates when we could borrow at than Ontario. That's gone now. So now we have to pay a premium relative to other provinces or other peer jurisdictions because we're deemed a riskier place for pension funds and global investors to buy our bonds.
Is this, sorry, I just have one more rapid fire question here, David, and I don't know if you're kind of historical looking. We hear a lot of people kind of referring to the 90s, late 90s, you know, as a last kind of basket case moment for British Columbia. Does this moment remind you of that moment? Is it a worthy comparison in your mind? Or is there another period? Oh. Have we been here before, I guess?
Yeah, well, I look at the interprovincial migration numbers. And if you look at outflows of British Columbians to other provinces, where it's back up around, 50 to 70,000 people a year leaving the province. And they're typically young workers between the ages of, 25 and 54, typically paying more in taxes than they consume in services. Young, educated people moving elsewhere. We haven't seen the numbers like this leaving the province since the late 90s and the mid 1970s. So, people do sense economic opportunity. They do look at the writing on the wall and say, I'm going to be on the hook for higher taxes in the future. This makes me question whether to base my operations here. I mean, just think about a young professional, if they succeed, and they use their degree, which they receive subsidized, from the taxpayer and from parents from a Canadian university, they can choose to succeed in Vancouver. But if their income goes over $260,000 a year, they'll be hit with a top tax rate of 53.5 cents on the dollar. 3 hours away is Seattle, where they could be earning a much higher market wage because the United States is a far more productive economy than Canada, and therefore their market incomes are much, much higher. But they're not going to hit the top tax rate, which is a federal one. Washington State doesn't even have provincial personal income tax. They'll pay federal tax, which is at the top rate is 37%, not 53.5, 37. And that won't kick in until they're on about $600,000 or $700,000 Canadian equivalent. So if you're a young professional, maybe you're in technology, maybe you're a terrific lawyer, but any kind of field you could name, engineer, where do you want to base yourselves? You could be in Seattle, which is only 3 hours away, or you could be here. We're not competitive. We're offering a lower market wage because our private sector economy is not doing very well, and a much higher personal income tax rate. So we're just not competitive about this. And the challenge, I think, with Donald Trump being in the White House, the challenge he's been putting on us since he was inaugurated last year, is that we used to say, come and base yourself in Canada. We've got rule of law, educated workforce, boundless natural resources, and guaranteed access to the United States market, which is a big, rich, and close. So it was a fantastic value proposition. But, what President Trump is saying is, explicitly, don't base yourself north of the 49th parallel. Base yourself in the United States as a company or as a high-skilled worker, and you'll be better off. And so we have to rethink our value proposition in Canada. The current model that we have of being, a low-income country, relatively low-income developed country with a very high tax rate and very generous wages and so forth and expansion of the public sector employment base, we can't really afford all of that. So I think we have to start rethinking the conditions on which our economy is built and go back to thinking about what would make the private sector economy more vibrant.
So, you outlined kind of the value proposition for Canada there. All of those things except the proximity to the U.S. seem to still be the case. Educated workforce, rule of law. Why is our productivity, I think a lot of people struggle with this, including myself. Why is our productivity levels so much lower than the United States or other countries? Because that seems to be the sticking point that we can't get a handle on. What's going on?
Well, think about what would make a company want to be more productive. And in a positive sense, it's because there's some opportunity there to make a profit, right? And then in a more of a carrot and stick approach, there's also another company chasing them down and perhaps ready to displace them in the market. So you have to innovate to stay ahead of them. And those pressures in Canada are a lot less than they are in the United States. About 21% of the Canadian economy, when you think about all the product markets there are out there, about 21%, I think, is the estimate I've seen from the Calgary School of Public Policy, are actually insulated from competition. So if you don't have to compete, you don't have to be at the technological frontier. Now, compare that to our exporters. Our exporters compete in international markets. So typically you'll find an exporting company in Canada is highly productive. It's a high productivity company. They do innovate. They do have to be the technological frontier. They don't have a choice. But if you're insulated from that, and we've got lots of markets where we've either got a government-only player or we've got just a duopoly or an oligopoly, we don't have enough competition there to spur that innovation. So that's one part of it. I think the innovation environment is less because we just have less intense competition. And the other part of it is our investment climate has been very, very poor, as I talked about earlier. So if I was trying to improve our productivity, it would be through improving the conditions for business investment and improving the conditions for competition and innovation.
Well, David, just thinking, and I mean, I think we've touched on a lot of solutions here, but just low-hanging fruit solutions, like what are some of the easiest things we can do to kind of try and spur on a positive outcome for our economy in the next couple of years here?
Well, at the top of my list would be the provincial sales tax regime. Unlike the value-added tax of the GST, the HST doesn't provide an import tax credit at each stage of the supply chain. So you have a really complex good that you're producing, and maybe there's 20 links in the chain, 20 different companies that supply parts to this thing that you're producing. And as this thing is passed along, the PST is added on at every stage. And so the final consumer ends up paying way more than 7% because all that cost is just embedded. Whereas with a value-added tax, you get an input tax credit all along. Each company gets an input tax credit for the tax that they paid, and the final consumer ends up just paying 5%. That's a much more efficient way of raising that revenue. So that would be right at the top of my list. And that is a real albatross around British Columbia's neck. And it's such an easy thing to change, is to move to a value-added tax approach rather than the provincial sales tax approach. Second on my list would be personal income tax reform. As I say, the rates of taxation are just too heavy. And if I could group those two things together, the PST and personal income taxes, the challenge there is what you're doing is your tax base is really dependent on things that are sensitive to taxation. So if someone goes and does something, they get dinged for it. They get taxed for it. So you lose a lot of economic activity to raise the revenue. You want to raise revenue from things that don't go anywhere if you put taxes on them. But our tax base is really based around things that, you know, people talk about it as punishing success. You know, I often use the example of somebody who's asked to do overtime at a hospital or a policeman or policewoman or something, but it'll push them into a higher tax bracket. So they choose not to do the extra hours because so much of it is clawed back in tax. And so they don't get the income. The police or the hospital don't get the extra hours, and the public doesn't get the service. So everybody loses from that model. And we've really lost sight of that balance, I think. Yes, the tax system needs to be fair, but it also needs to encourage people to strive and to succeed. And that's what we've lost sight of, I think. So those were the top of my list. You know, we also have we still have too many barriers around internal trade in Canada, though we've made some positive steps in the last year. But having freer trade with ourselves, I think, is another easy win to go with. And then on the provincial budget, where we've really lost control of operating spending has been in sort of four areas. It's been healthcare, regional services and MSP, and child welfare services, and also debt servicing. So I'd be looking at those areas in particular about how to get back in control of our operating expenses as a province.
So I'm just thinking, because I have right now there's a collective bargaining negotiation going on with the nurses in British Columbia. My sense here is that most people would support nurses getting a pay raise. At the same time, you've already highlighted, you know, four collective bargaining agreements that are very generous, a provincial government that has painted itself in a corner where they basically have to stop the largesse at some point. How do you think that plays out, just out of curiosity? Like, is it possible that
for folks that are doing such, you know, basically God's work, right? The nurses, like that is tough work. And to not get, you know, at least a living wage or a wage that reflects inflation is a tough pill to swallow. But what's your take there? Is it just like we gotta put the hammer down here and stop with the generous compensation packages? Or like, what's your take there?
Yeah, well, I mean, the nurses do tremendous work, you know, as we know, but you know, they're struggling. Like, if we were paying what we're paying and seeing, you know, a first class healthcare system in the province, I think people would be pretty generous in thinking about these issues. But the fact of the matter is that we're spending a tremendous sum in the budget on healthcare. We've grown that prodigiously over the last 5 years, but we're not seeing the outcomes that we would like from it. When you see closed emergency rooms, very long waits for procedures, that they're not the outcomes that we should be seeing. So I think the government, having given the wage increases that it's given to the BCGEU and others of, you know, 1% above 3% a year for 4 years, I mean, that's probably the starting point of the negotiations, I would imagine, on this. But there is a broader problem in the way the province is managing the healthcare system, because we're not seeing the outcomes. We're seeing tremendous levels of spending, but we're not seeing the outcomes commensurate with the level of spending. And so if pouring more money into the system would lead to better outcomes, I think British Columbians would be quite supportive of it. But the evidence today doesn't really suggest that that's true.
David, maybe as a final question here, obviously we are a real estate podcast. We often forget that and talk about everything but real estate. What are the implications of all this for the real estate market here in Vancouver and in BC?
Well, it's a pretty challenging outlook. If you talk to any developers, they'll tell you that the pre-sale market is extremely weak. The only game in town at the moment seems to be the publicly funded construction for rental in particular. So it's a pretty challenging outlook. But, you know, what's really happened in real estate, for my sins, I did my doctorate on this a few years ago. So I'm a recovering housing economist, I like to say. but we had a 25-year boom in credit growth in Canada. You know, during the 90s, over a three-year period, remember 3 years is about the midpoint of our turnover, our mortgage stock, you know, because most of our mortgages are 1 to 5 years. So over a three-year period, we used to see about $50 billion of credit in mortgages. So this is like a type of money that you can only use to buy housing, right? Either mostly resale, but some new homes as well. That got up to huge levels before the global financial crisis. And then when the Bank of Canada cut rates in 2015, it poured petrol on the fire again, and that got going again with low interest rates. And then COVID was kind of an inferno. So over a three-year period from 2021 to 2023 inclusive, with interest rates being zero and quantitative easing, we saw basically a $500 billion increase, or a one-third increase, in the amount of mortgage credit outstanding. Yeah, a one-third increase essentially in the money supply that could be only used by housing. So, you know, what do you think the price did? And the price at that time for resales went through the roof, absolutely through the roof, as you'd expect. But what we've seen since then is, you know, inflation, consumer inflation went up to about 8%. So you saw the central banks around the world ratchet up interest rates. And so mortgage rates have really returned to where they were in the mid-2000s, so 2006 era, which is a big change from the interest rates that we were seeing. And of course, quantitative easing has also been turned off. Forward guidance is gone. So all that stimulus that was coming from the Bank of Canada and from central banks around the world has been reversed. And that's why you've seen the real estate market, not just in BC and in Canada, but around the world, has really been in a big decline. So I talked about credit growth earlier. We went from creating about $500 billion of credit over a three-year period back down to sort of the $50 to $100 billion over a three-year period that we would see in the 90s. So something, your credit is really the oxygen of the real estate market. Most transactions involve credit. And that turning off the credit taps, turning off the money supply taps, has really had a huge impact on the resale market. And then that, you know, downloads onto the pre-sale market as well.
Is that the numbers you cited there, kind of back to the 90s, is that adjusted for population change, or is that just those, the numbers that we used to see?
Adjusted for inflation. Yeah. Huge levels. And we went from the Canadians owing about $1.6 trillion against the real estate stock. This is the total number of houses that exist in Canada, apartments and so forth, to $2.1 trillion in 3 years. $1.6 trillion to $2.1 trillion in 3 years. It's an enormous increase, a one-third increase. So, you know, the only way that what's going to happen there is the price is going to go up. The idea that you're going to build, you know, a third as many houses as it's taken you 150 years to build, you're going to do it again in 3 years, you know, to offset the price increase, it's just, it's not realistic. So that's a big downer on the real estate sector as we adjust to interest rates being back to where they were in the mid-2000s. That's a big factor. For the new construction market, you know, there's still some headwinds there, big headwinds from, you know, developer cost charges, municipal charges, which are pretty hefty. I mean, Urban Development Institute estimates they're about a third, just under a third of the cost of a new build. And then that worked when the market was booming, you know, when all this credit was coming down the pipe. But now that it isn't, you know, that model just doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work for municipal finances either.
What do you think the balance of this year and we're moving forward, maybe the next 1 to 3 years in our market, do we find our footing here, or have we hit bottom, or is there more pain?
I think in the new construction market, there's probably some more pain to come, because just the way starts are counted, they're counted when they get to grade. So the starts that we're seeing in the data now reflect projects that began, you know, a year or more ago. So there's been this dearth of new projects going forward, particularly those that aren't sponsored by the taxpayer. So I think we are going to see quite a bit of a funk in new construction activity over the next couple of years at least. Bit of a reprieve, I think, comes perhaps from interest rates coming down slightly from where they were. They're still much, much higher, but they have come down a little bit at least. But the, you know, they're not going back to where they were. It's, you know, 5-year fixed at 1.5%. For 5 years. Those days are in the rearview mirror.
Well, maybe we'll leave it there. David, we do have this segment called the Five Wire, Five Lighthearted Questions to end the show. Do you have time to stick around for that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so question number one, David, one book you've read recently that you would recommend for our listeners?
Well, it's a book I reread. It's called Unconventional Success by David Swensen. The late David Swensen ran the Yale Endowment Portfolio. And it's a really great book, you know, as an introduction to how to succeed in investing. There's really key principles around that. It's terrific. And I recommend that to family and friends.
Well, that's a great one. All right. In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
Probably getting up early in the morning and going for a walk before I get ready and go to work. That's been good. Just clear my head. And, you know, my old boss back a few years ago, 20 years ago, used to swear by walking in the morning. So I think it's been really helpful.
Oh, that's a great one. Question number three, what have you been binge watching lately, or a movie recommendation?
Oh, I don't think what we've watched. I have a 4-year-old. So if it's not, Lightning McQueen, anything that's not Lightning
Paw Patrol.
McQueen is great.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you're not watching, so you're not watching There Will Be Blood in the movie. Right. Favorite band or music? I have a feeling I know where this is going.
Favorite what, sorry?
Band or music recommendation.
Oh, well, Midnight Oil for the Australiana, and maybe the High Kings for the Irish folk.
I thought you were going to go Cold Chisel, but Midnight Oil. Okay, we'll take
also
it.
Also good.
Last but not least, something you have purchased for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life.
A few months ago, we had family staying and we had the dishwasher break, and it was just chaos at our house. Absolute chaos. And with a four-year-old, I mean, they just make a complete mess of everything all the time. And we bought a new dishwasher, but the other thing we bought was a robot back and mop to do the floors. And it is life-changing. It was on special. It's fantastic.
it's a Chinese brand? I had a client robot tell me that it's like about $800, but it literally just...
Yeah, it was hugely discounted. I guess they're bringing out a new model. But it's just terrific. You know, you can go and watch Lightning McQueen, you know, for an hour. And then, the house is being cleaned. And then my son can just get to work making a mess of it all over again. But I don't mind so much because the robot's going to take care of it. It's just manufactured so much time. It's been fantastic.
And this is a mop? Like it does engineered wood or hardwood floors?
Yeah, it does. Most of our house is wooden floor, and it just, you know, goes around, sweeps it all, and then mops it. Very intelligent. It's terrific. It just saves so much work. It's created so much time for us, honestly.
My client also said it changed his life, honestly, that it's like you have a robot cleaning your house all the time. interestingly enough, the same guy, just speaking of productivity, spent 3 months in China, and he said coming back to Vancouver was like going back in time 10 to 15 years is what it felt like. so I don't know if that says anything positive about where we're at, but
yeah, I feel one step closer to the technological frontier.
Well, David, how can people find out more about what you're up to and follow along?
Yeah, all our publications are published on bcbc.com. We have do a lot of media as well. And I present to a lot of business groups and other groups. I did about 45 presentations last year. So a lot of material is out there. And first place to look is at our website, bcbc.com.
Thanks so much again for your time.
Matt, Adam, thanks very much. Pleasure.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with David Williams, VP of Policy over at the Business Council of BC, and soon to be past guest fan favorite, I feel like, because we got to get David back on the show.
Yeah, he was great. Super, super bright guy, super analytical, had a lot of ideas that we haven't actually had on the show before. And talk about, he's representing 180 of the province's largest employers. So just goes to show how important his role is, and what a bright guy.
Yeah, but pretty depressing. Pretty depressing overall. I don't think you can leave that conversation thinking, you know, we're on the right path right now. But maybe we'll leave it there. The sun's out, Adam, and let's focus on the positives.
I only lick my wounds on dreary days. Yeah, you're right, Matt. What else do we got before we cut for the day?
What else do we have? Well, Adam, we can advertise VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, our website where all things real estate related live. But more importantly, we would just like to point out that we have worked with hundreds of people that have listened to the podcast over the years and had some extremely positive relationships with clients that have developed from the podcast. So if you are a listener, you're thinking of buying or selling in Metro Vancouver or even beyond, get in touch. We would love to chat and see how we can help. You can always try me at 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
I was thinking, Adam, trying to figure out, you know, this, we called it the nonpartisan line. We called it the Kokomo line. Should we call it the five-star review on Google for Scalina Real Estate line?
Sure. Yeah.
Because that's what we have. We are maintaining a five out of five star review.
The five-star line, sure.
The five-star line, five-star review line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. That's it for the week, and we will be back. Wendy Waters is coming on soon. That's an exciting one for sure. Wait. And but yeah, tons of great episodes coming up. So we'll talk to you next week.
I feel like we're hitting them out of the park. Everybody's talking, some really diverse guests, some really great content. Appreciate everybody listening. You found this useful. Share it with a friend. And thanks again. Take care.
2000 Faces for Radio.
Subscribe today.